So we asked, of course, about clinical research, and for those oncologists participating, of course, dramatic decreases. We also found that there are a fair amount of lack of access to basic therapies, surgery, radiation therapy throughout the country. I'm kind of curious. There have been a lot of guidelines that have come out with the ideas, if you're in this situation where you can't get access, how do you get around it? Many comments about that from the point of view of lung cancer. I know there were situations even in some places where primary curative surgery, you know, there was a problem. People ended up using neoadjuvant therapy. Any comments on that?
I think we have to be a little bit creative with a good understanding of each disease stage and its process as to what we can afford to delay and what we can't. You know, for example, if we had a small ground glass opacity changing a bit, we might take it for resection versus observe, maybe on the fence. I think in the midst of very high COVID-19 numbers, much less likely to take that person to the OR. We know that surgical outcomes in patients with COVID-19, even if asymptomatic, seem to be quite poor. In cases where resources, particularly operating room or surgeon access, are limited, are there other strategies that won't compromise outcomes, but can potentially safely delay the need for operation? Neoadjuvant therapy, a good example of that. And an interesting trial from Dr. Palma in Canada looking at neoadjuvant stereotactic radiation therapy before surgery and allowing those several months for the radiation effect before surgical resection, not felt to really be compromising care. And actually, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, really bringing about this potentially really creative, innovative clinical trial, which can answer some research questions. And I think that is probably one example where the COVID had led to that trial. I think overall, clinical trial enrollment is down, certainly at our institution, but I think elsewhere. Part of that is due to decreasing staff, decreasing capacity, having fewer people around to support those trials. But we know that it's happening across the country. If we look at enrollment to NCI-sponsored trials, it has been fairly steady. A good example would be SWOG enrollments, which were very steady through much of recent history. And if you look at early 2020, monthly accruals were somewhere between 125 and 150, remarkably consistent. And as soon as we saw this COVID-19 pandemic, we saw a sharp drop. By April 2020, that number, which was between 125 and 50, dropped down to about 50, which is particularly concerning. And so weekly enrollments going from 125, 150 down to 50 is, I think, a good barometer for how hesitant people were to enroll in trials and how much COVID-19 has really disabled a lot of our trial infrastructure.
So we also asked questions about whether or not they're avoiding any type of cancer therapy, concerned about in general, not. And it's interesting, in general, I found their viewpoints very lined up a lot with what we're hearing from clinical investigators. So I think people are trying to get this information and in general, I think kind of providing the same answers. This is another interesting question we asked, which was related to interval you were mentioning before between IOs, but in terms of pembrolizumab now with the approval every 6 weeks. I was surprised that not everybody didn't just jump on it, you know, but I heard some people, particularly in a patient just getting started, they're kind of hesitant. Any thoughts about that?
I must say I'm a little surprised as well. When I saw the 400 milligram approval by the FDA, to me, the timing was perfect. And we know that the initial application was a bit delayed. When I saw this come through, I thought this was so fitting for the time. We have comparable tox outcomes on smaller data sets, but still nothing I'm concerned about with giving it less frequently and reducing the number of visits to the hospital, reducing the number of people within my infusion center. It really seemed like a win-win for everyone.
So another question we asked is about testing, and particularly we know there's a lot of questions about patients about to begin therapy. It looks like there's kind of consensus about surgery. I mean, that makes sense, particularly if they have to be admitted to the hospital. But, you know, people are seeing pretty split about whether you test somebody who's getting started on systemic therapy or radiation. I know that you don't test that. What is your rationale?
Our policy isn't to test asymptomatic people at this time, but I will say that's changing. And part of it has to do with your capacity for testing. We wouldn't want to overflow our testing centers, which would delay results for other people that may be more at need. And so anyone who's undergoing a procedure clearly gets tested. If the capacity were there and we could do that test instantaneously for everyone, I think there's little downside to doing that testing. But if you're testing someone with radiation therapy, with chemotherapy, how frequently do you test? While it may delay your initiation, are you going to test them every day if it impacts holds or delays in therapy? Because patients can turn positive at any time. So I think that testing strategies are evolving. It's going to be influenced a bit by the incidence where you are and your suspicion, but certainly a low threshold to test. Any contact, any symptoms, we're doing testing right away.
So this question turned out to be, I think, one of the most interesting questions we asked. How disruptive has the pandemic been on your ability to keep up to date with new cancer advances? And you can see a substantial number of people are finding it disruptive. And interestingly, when I interviewed Tiffany Traina earlier this week, she listed herself as a 4, which I thought was interesting. And I said, why? She just said, we're just so crazy busy. I just can't spend the amount of time that I usually do. I see it doesn't seem to have affected you as much, but I thought it was pretty interesting.
It's a very interesting question because there are a few different ways it could be disruptive. One is just delivery of information. And I think a lot of us learn better in person. You know, when I go to ASCO, I will admit I probably get more out of it than a virtual meeting. And I understand the value of virtual, particularly in the current environment. But when I physically go to a meeting, when I'm hearing it, it sticks a bit better. And so being virtual is somewhat disruptive, but all the organizations, ASCO, AACR, ISLAC, yourself, making these available remotely has really allowed us to participate in some ways even more than we have before. So in that sense, I think that it is much less disruptive, but I think delivering care does make us busier. You know, we've been doing in-person clinics for decades and we've gotten very good at it. We've gotten very efficient. And I don't think we have that efficiency with telemedicine and delivering remote care. And there are a lot of barriers, whether it's delays in access, technology. Frankly, I have to serve as an IT help desk for a lot of my patients, walking them through how to turn on their video.
And absolutely,
these delays just limit the number of people we could see in a day. And that sort of, as you'd mentioned, that takes away a finite amount of time that we have. And so that can also be disruptive.
Anything else you want to add to what we've talked about today? Anything that might have popped into your head that we didn't talk about?
I really think that the big message to get out there is that patients should not be afraid to come in because we are seeing these delays, we're seeing these concerns. And what we've noticed over the past few months is a very sharp decline in the incidence of lung cancer, in the incidence of heart attacks. Our ER visits, we're seeing fewer asthma exacerbations, fewer COPD exacerbations, fewer ST elevation MIs. I don't think that's because of preventative medicine all of a sudden kicking in. I think people are dealing with these at home and not coming in until they're in extremis. And as we know, early intervention for many conditions is the key to success. When we see these delays, people are going to do worse. And what we will notice a year from now is a stage migration where there are going to be more people that advance with late stages. Your stage ones will be stage twos. Your stage threes will unfortunately be stage fours. And a lot of your stage fours will never get access to treatment that they otherwise would have. This is going to influence outcomes. And in years to come, we're going to see a step back in some of the advances we've made. Another thing that we won't notice for years are all the preclinical advances. A lot of the work and the trials that we're implementing today are built on stuff in the lab that's being done. And while we have worked hard to keep our clinics open to deliver clinical care, the research laboratories are quiet. They've gone dark because we can't expose those lab workers, students to risk. And when they do open, there will be space constraints. Many of these lab facilities are very small, and so they can't accommodate more than one person. Some experiments we do just require multiple people in the lab at the same time. We won't be able to do it. How many preclinical models have we lost because of these months' delays in some of that important preclinical work? We'll pay for that later, and I'm a little worried to see what the result of that will be.
Really interesting. Any theory on why, if it's true, I think I read it, why there are fewer premature births?
Oh, I haven't heard that. Oh, I'd have to think about that.
Like, why? Really? Apparently, it's really for real.
Oh, my. Yeah, that I don't know. That's an interesting one.
Yeah. I mean, when you say there are fewer heart attacks, too, like, well, where are these people going? Are they dying at home? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's what they are. And that is a mortality cost of COVID-19 that won't be reflected on those charts we see. While COVID-19 can directly lead to the death of a lot of people, how many millions more have died from untreated or undertreated heart disease, diabetes, cancer? That's another toll and another cost that COVID-19 has.